In a prior episode, I mentioned that President Kennedy, who lost Dallas by some 60,000 votes in the 1960 election, was not looking forward to visiting. He knew he was unpopular there, but he was perhaps even more concerned about his wife and her visit to Big D. William Manchester, in his magnificent 1967 book, The Death of a President, writes that Kennedy was nervous about the trip and was afraid that Jackie would later regret having gone. He wanted Jacqueline to enjoy herself so she would make other trips with him during the 1964 campaign. The First Lady was indeed apprehensive about the trip. On November 15th, at the Kennedys' country home near Middleburg, Virginia, she discussed it with a friend. The trip was now just a week away, and Jackie was particularly worried about Dallas. As mentioned in an earlier episode, UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson had recently been assaulted in Dallas, and Mrs. Kennedy was worried about the city's reputation for violence. She told her friend, quote, "I'll hate every minute of it," unquote. Then, referring to her husband, Jackie added, "But if he wants me there, then that's all that matters. It's a tiny sacrifice on my part for something that he feels is very important to him." And for the first time in their 10-year marriage, John F. Kennedy actually wanted to know what Jackie was going to wear, referring to the looming Dallas luncheon, now scheduled to be held at the Trademark. Kennedy said, "You've got to look marvelous. Show these Texans what good taste really is." And so, days ahead of their departure, the First Lady wrote out, in her distinctive handwriting, the clothes that she would wear in Dallas. For Big D, she scribbled, "Pink and navy Chanel suit, navy shoes, navy bag, and white kid gloves." And to top it off, she added, "One pink pillbox hat." I'm Paul Brandis. You're listening to Countdown to Dallas, a podcast series based on my book of the same title. While Jackie enjoyed the countryside, her husband was in New York speaking to a Catholic youth organization.
How many actually do come from Boston or Massachusetts here?
In my last episode, I mentioned that Kennedy, like every president before him, often took chances with his safety. On the drive into Manhattan, he rode without the usual police escort clearing the highways. Why? He did not want to cause a delay in the evening rush hour. At one point, another car nearly got between the president's car and the Secret Service follow-up vehicle. The driver ignored shouts from the agents until one agent pointed a rifle out the window. Minutes later, Kennedy's car stopped at a red light at the intersection of Madison Avenue and 72nd Street. Suddenly, a photographer, a woman, came out of nowhere and rushed up to the president's side of the car, pushed her camera against his window, and fired its flashbulb. A New York police official said, quote, "She might well have been an assassin," unquote. Two security scares in a matter of minutes, largely because Kennedy generally preferred to downplay his security. At a party that night, Kennedy ran into his UN ambassador, Adlai Stevenson, who, as mentioned a minute ago, was attacked in Dallas 3 weeks earlier. Stevenson warned the president about going. Also at the party was Ole Cassini, one of Mrs. Kennedy's fashion designers. After overhearing the Kennedy-Stevenson chat, he also pressed JFK, "Why do you go? Your own people are saying you should not." The president said nothing and shrugged. "I will not live in fear," he once told his doctor. "What will be, must be." Why the nonchalance, the seeming ambivalence about his own safety? This was the man who once said he would never make it to age 45. Now he was just beyond that, 46. The man whose favorite poem was called "I Have a Rendezvous with Death," the man who noted that since 1860, every president elected in a year ending in zero had died in office. and so thoughts of death were often top of mind. Secret Service agent Winston Lawson tells this story about the time his family was introduced to the president in upstate New York.
He walked the fence line like he did here in Dallas later, and like all presidents usually do, or vice presidents or whatever. And I didn't introduce my family to him, but one of the supervisors on the detail who was standing next to him said words to the effect, Mr. President, this is Agent Lawson's family. And President Kennedy said, well, he must be doing a pretty good job because nobody has shot me yet. Now, I mean, when you think of what happened a year later, I mean, to hear something like that is just mind-boggling.
Yes, it is, and it shows again how thoughts of death, of being shot, were often on Kennedy's mind. He was so preoccupied with the idea of death that in September 1963, he even starred in a home movie in which he was assassinated. That's according to Robert L. Knudsen, a White House photographer at the time. In a 1983 book, A Hero for Our Time was the title. He says the Kennedys and friends were spending the weekend in Newport, Rhode Island. Knudsen says, quote, the president wrote the script. He called me over one day and said they wanted to have some fun and shoot a movie, unquote. Here's an excerpt from that 1983 book, quote, the man with the binoculars watched President Kennedy as he got off the honey fits at Newport and walked down the long pier. Suddenly, Kennedy clutched his chest and fell flat on the ground. Walking behind him was the dignified Countess Crespi and her small son. Both simply stepped over the president's body as if he were not there and continued walking toward the shore. Right behind the Countess came Jacqueline Kennedy, and she, too, daintily stepped over her husband's body. Behind her was Red Fay, Under Secretary of the Navy, and President Kennedy's PT boat buddy. Fay stumbled and fell directly on the president's body. Just then, a gush of red, probably tomato juice, surged from the president's mouth, covering his sports shirt, unquote. This was also reported at the time, by the way, by the Associated Press in a dispatch dated September 21st, 1963. It's not known what became of the eerie home movie, which you will not find in the archives of the Kennedy Library in Boston. Quite a story, isn't it? Kennedy even discussed being assassinated on the very morning of his murder. I'll share that story in a future episode.
More Countdown to Dallas right after this quick break.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Hi, folks. Paul Brandis here, the host of Countdown to Dallas on Evergreen. With Factor, you can choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, that's my favorite, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feeling good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's 39 ready-to-eat meals so you can get back to doing what you love this spring. And if you're looking for gourmet meals, try meals from Factor that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. All you do is heat and savor the good stuff. They're also tailored to your schedule. Customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Just pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for our lowest carbon footprint meals. All you do here, head to factormeals.com/ COUNTDOWN50 and use code COUNTDOWN50, that's the number 50, to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code COUNTDOWN50 at factormeals.com/COUNTDOWN50 to get half off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Around 10,000 BCE, families and tribes of the ancestors to the people of Britain would arrive in the southern part of the island after crossing from land that bridged from Europe. The Welsh built houses, communities, kingdoms, and continued to survive through Romans, Saxons, Danes, and Normans. The language and culture influenced by these sources continued to change and thrive, becoming ancient and modern at the same time. Join me as we travel through the history, meeting the kings, queens, nobles, and everyday people that create and grew modern Wales from the seeds of the ancient past. Creoso, and welcome to the Welsh History Podcast.
Meanwhile, as the Kennedys' departure for Texas loomed, what was Lee Harvey Oswald up to? Now, to recap, in the spring and summer of 1963, he'd been fired from a couple of jobs, arrested, thought about hijacking a plane, unable to get a visa to go to Cuba, and beat and abused his wife, Marina, who essentially left him to live with a woman she barely knew. Oh, and Oswald, lest we forget, the Walker shooting was also an attempted assassin. Now it's October and November 1963. Oswald is working yet another menial job, this time at the Texas School Book Depository. How he got that job is explained easily in episode 14 of this series. In these final weeks, there is no, and as always, this is the operative phrase, no conclusive verifiable proof that anything sinister was going on in Oswald's life. In fact, his life is humdrum and banal. He rode the bus to work, rode the bus home, didn't go out at night, didn't do much of anything. Let me play again these observations from Gladys Johnson, the landlord at his boarding house, who spoke with CBS the day after the assassination.
What about his habits? Did he, was he friendly and talk to people?
No. He didn't.
Tell me what he did.
Well, he just taking care of his own business. He only come in the living room occasionally and look at the television, and he'd go back to his room.
He would sit here and look at TV with you?
Yeah, maybe six or eight would be in the living room.
Other rumors here, too. He would sit in here with us. Did he ever carry on a conversation with you?
No, never did. No one.
Ever make any comments about things that he saw and heard on TV?
He didn't. He didn't make comments on anything.
Do you know whether he ever made any phone calls?
Yes, he sure did. He'd make one or two phone calls, usually in the afternoons after coming in from work. And they would always be they wouldn't be in English.
Not in English?
Not in English.
What kind of a language was he speaking in?
Either, I presume, German or Russian. I don't know.
Did anybody ever call him here?
I never did take a call for him at all.
How about friends? Do you know whether he had any friends, or did you ever see any?
Never did. No, sir. Sure didn't.
So we can account for Oswald's time during the week. Never went anywhere, never spoke with anyone, except for those calls in Russian to Marina out in Irving. On Fridays, he'd catch a lift there with his depository workmate, Buell Wesley Frazier. What did Oswald do on his weekends in Irving? Here's Ruth Payne on PBS's Frontline.
He came out each weekend. He and Marina did argue a good bit, and I was somewhat impatient with him. She was saying, you see, he doesn't love me. All the time I knew her, she was worried about whether he loved her or not.
And here's Michael Payne, Ruth's estranged husband.
Well, he came out on weekends. I remember stepping over him one time as he was watching TV, watching the football game, his chin in his hands there, and thinking, what a fine little a revolutionary we have here being snookered into the new opiate of the people, football.
Pan and Oswald also discussed politics.
He thought capitalism was rotten. It was a fraud, and it needed to be overthrown. Lee wanted to be an active guerrilla in the effort to bring about a new world order.
And Michael Payne added, Oswald said this.
There was no doubt in my mind that he believed violence was the only effective tool. He didn't want to mess around with trying to change the system.
So that's how he spent his weekends, in Irving with his family, watching football, and advocating the use of violence to overthrow the system. On Mondays, he'd ride back to work with Frazier. Now, even though we can account for Oswald's time, both during the week and on weekends, after the assassination, people came out of the woodwork and said they were sure they saw him everywhere from Hawaii to Florida, at bowling alleys, dance halls, and more. Some context might be helpful here. These alleged sightings were weeks, months before the assassination. Oswald was an unremarkable-looking man who rarely spoke to anyone. He never had any money to flash around, didn't stand out in any way. Yet after November 22nd, he would magically be remembered in stories told by people who vividly recalled seeing him all over the map. For all of the criticism that conspiracy buffs usually direct at the Warren Commission, the House Select Committee on Assassinations looked into these alleged Oswald sightings in the late 1970s. G. Robert Blakey was chief counsel and staff director to the committee.
All of this testimony has to be taken very seriously. All of it has to be taken with an enormous grain of salt. These are people who did not know Oswald and who are subsequently remembering, oh, the guy involved in the assassination is the guy I saw weeks and months ago. This is the least credible testimony unless it can be specifically corroborated.
And after three-fifths of a century, it never has been. Oswald wasn't exactly someone you'd remember. Again, he did not stand out, never spoke to anybody. None of these alleged sightings have ever panned out. Again, the vast preponderance of evidence tells us that Oswald maintained a humdrum routine, boarding house to bus to work and back again in the evening. There is no concrete, verifiable proof that he was up to anything fishy or met with anyone who was. As University of Virginia professor and historian Larry Sabato notes in his terrific The Kennedy Half Century, none of these claims have stood up to rigorous inquiry. Quote, assassination researchers frequently encounter chronicles that seem promising on the surface, he quotes, but end up leading nowhere or raising a host of unanswerable questions. Speaking of questions, by the way, conspiracy buffs also often ask, why wasn't the Secret Service told about Oswald? We've talked about this before, but it bears repeating. FBI agent James Hostey, who inherited Oswald's file in 1962, discussed this in the 1986 trial of Oswald, the mock trial on British television. The first voice you'll hear is that of prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi.
Mr. Hostey, the charge has been made, I'm not saying it's valid, that Oswald was a dangerous enough person for you to have alerted the Secret Service about Oswald before President Kennedy came to Dallas.
The only thing that we could tell the Secret Service was a direct threat to the president. He made no direct threat to the president, therefore we could not tell them.
Oswald was a defector, unstable, barely employable. Neighbors, coworkers, the emigre community in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, no one liked him very much and generally considered him to be an oddball, angry, with delusions of grandeur. But these attributes, negative as they are, did not mean that he was seen as a physical threat to anyone, certainly not a potential assassin. There was no record of him threatening anyone, and no one knew that he owned a rifle. Gun laws were such that he was able to buy it and his .38 through the mail using an alias anyway. And as mentioned, no one other than Marina had any idea that he had tried to kill General Walker back in April. So to return again to the central point, Oswald was not considered a security risk to the president. There was no evidence that he was. But the FBI still wanted to know if Oswald or Marina were somehow working for the Soviet Union. On November the 1st, Agent Hostey visited the Payne residence in Irving. Ruth told him that Marina and her two children lived with her, but Lee lived elsewhere, but she didn't know where. She said she'd try and find an address, but remember, Oswald was living under a phony name, O.H. Lee, his initials in reverse, and never told anyone where he was. Hostey also learned that Oswald was working at the Texas School Book Depository. On Monday, November 4th, Hostey called the depository to confirm this. But remember, this was November 4th. As mentioned earlier, the location for President Kennedy's Dallas visit would not be decided until November 14th, and it would be decided not by some sinister force, but by Ken O'Donnell, the top White House aide to the president himself. Why didn't Hostey go down to the depository and interview Oswald? To some, that seems fishy. But the fact was, FBI agents had heavy caseloads, lots of people to keep tabs on. Even so, Hostey was closing in, and again, Oswald was not known to be a threat. By the way, that same day, November the 4th, the Dallas Morning News reported that President Kennedy would visit Dallas on either November 21st or November 22nd. No other details, no venues, no times, no nothing was reported because those details had yet to be worked out. If you like this podcast, check out my book of the same title, Countdown to Dallas. Sound from the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas, CBS News, C-SPAN, the PBS program Frontline, and London Weekend Television. Our editor and producer, Aaron Land. Audio engineer, Sean Rule Hoffman. Executive producers, Michael DeAloia and Gerardo Orlando. I'm Paul Brandis. Thanks so much for listening.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tom Kearns, and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far, we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.